reports with Howard Braun interviewing Dr. Leonard Schwartz for the Pittsburgh section of National Council of Jewish Women. It is October 8th, and we're on the third part of the oral history interview. Dr. Schwartz, this being the last interview, we're here just to put it all together, I suppose. Okay. Before we go any further, could you tell us which professional organizations you belong to today, or that you have belonged to?
The American Medical Association. The American Medical Association. The American Psychiatric Association. The American Geriatric. Alpha Omega Alpha is the honorary medical fraternity.
Whatever. Say that again?
Alpha AOA. Alpha Omega Alpha. The American College of Sports Medicine. I'm running out of them quick. There may be a few others, but since I can't remember sending a check recently, which is the dues, I can't tell you what they are.
Are there any
related to that? You mentioned dues. What licenses do you have?
Yeah, I'm licensed to practice medicine in the state of Pennsylvania. And I'm a graduate of the Pittsburgh Psychoanalytic Association, so I'm an analyst type too. I forgot about it. Interesting, I would forget that.
Mm-hmm.
Must be significant.
What's the name of it?
It's a Freudian. Huh?
What's the name of it?
It's the Pittsburgh Psychoanalytic.
Thank you.
Are there any awards or honors you'd like to mention?
No.
You'd like to know.
Royalties.
Okay.
Those are rewards.
They certainly are.
I enjoy those. They're not very honorary.
Dr. Schwartz, how did you go from Freudian to clinical? Or how was the evolution made?
See, clinical, when you take a residency in psychiatry, you're essentially introduced to bread and butter conventional psychiatry as it's practiced by all the psychiatrists in the country. A small percentage of those elect to study psychoanalysis. That was available to me at Western Psychiatric where I took my residency. In the third year of my residency, I decided to join the psychoanalytic, to apply to the Psychoanalytic Institute, and was accepted. And so that began another dozen years of study to get me ready to become a full-fledged psychoanalyst. But the flow is from generalist to specialist. That is, Freudian psychology or psychiatry is only one variant. In many ways, go. Freud is the most popular technique that people opt for. I must say that after I began practice, and even after I graduated from the Analytic Institute in 1968, my work, while it was always tinged by my knowledge of experience with Freudian psychology, was not dominated. I'm what I call eclectic. I go any way I can. Some patients don't lend themselves to Freudian hypotheses, as far as I'm concerned. Other things should be used for them. And so I have done dozens of different things in the area of psychotherapy. For one thing, I find any one of them dull after a while. And I think personal expansion is made more possible if you learn a number of disciplines. And I believe that about exercise, for example. It's exactly the way I practice working out. In many ways, there are parallels, incidentally.
So is it like a building block?
Freudian psychology, it's another module of awareness and experience that you can build into the practice of psychiatry. Today, for example, Freudian psychology is far less dominant of the whole species than it was when I was a student. You know, other things have happened. We used to analyze sexual problems by using the psychoanalytic techniques. After the advent of sexual therapies, you know, they gave up all that stuff and went right to the heart of the matter, took care of patients much more quickly than a psychoanalyst could in a 2-year analysis, for example. And I think that made all kinds of sense. Freudian psychology remains to me a very good practical and theoretical approach to certain problems. When the problem is dominated by an unconscious element, which is not apparent clearly to the patient, some form of uncovering treatment, which may be formal psychoanalysis, may not be, is the order of the day. Some people don't have, their problem is not that they don't understand what's unconscious, but rather much grosser problems, and psychoses, for example. We don't have to uncover their unconscious. It's already at the surface. That's the problem. I don't know if that answers your question.
Not bad.
Huh?
Not bad.
What?
That was it.
Okay.
Is there anything in your life you would wish to have changed?
I'd like to be tall.
That's not bad, right? It's been a pretty happy life.
That's only kidding on the square. I mean, it's kidding on the square. Actually, my stature has been in many ways an advantage to me, especially in athletics and certain kinds of sports, particularly not only small height, not the average height, which is what they call me, but keeping myself lean and small and muscular has been a great advantage to in sports. It makes me able to do literally what 99 out of 999 17-year-olds can't do. So to me, that's a minor miracle, and I own that miracle. So that's kind of fun. Now, what would I change in my life? I think being born into poverty was only a partial advantage. I can see advantages to being born into a situation where material things were not sought after all the time, not always on the plate, you know. But I'm not sure that would have worked out any better. It's just at the speculation. Otherwise, I have really no regrets. I've lived the kind of life I want to live.
Do you
want to
elaborate at all? I know we've certainly discussed your motivation, but is there anything else you'd like to add to the motivation to go into medicine or psychiatry?
I have thought oftentimes of alternative professions for me, and the more I think about it, the more I think I was very lucky to have chosen this. That I would have been at a great disadvantage relative to what I enjoy if I had chosen engineering or law, for example. If I didn't know I could write, if I had discovered writing as a way of working, I think I would have maybe moved in that direction very early in my life. You know, and made that a craft, made language a fetish, think I would have done that. I don't know how that would have ended up either. I doubt that I would have written a great American novel. I don't think I'm so constituted. Taking care of people, the power, there is an empowerment involved in taking care of patients. And while I've done very well since I've stopped practice, there isn't a day goes by that I don't miss that contact with people. When I say power, it's probably a bad word. There's a sense of control and a sense of giving, and maybe you can use the word power, all rolled into one, that comes from listening carefully to the way people run their lives and having experience that enables you to set certain things straight with them, whether it means pulling up the unconscious and making it relevant or not. You know. But I always went home, not only tired, but with a great sense of having accomplished a large number of small things.
Could you tell us about something that stands out in terms of what you thought was a true accomplishment or success?
There were no spectacular things. Or at least I doubt that you would consider them spectacular. I never considered them spectacular. It's just that I always had the feeling that if this, that, or the other hadn't been accomplished, this person would have lived 30, 40, 50, 60 more years without the energy provided by the insight. And to me, that's like adding a life almost. You add energy to a life, and that's precisely what I viewed psychiatry as being. Medicine would have felt the same thing to me. When you take pain and symptom away from a human being, you add energy to that life. The subtraction of pain is one thing, but its functional equivalent in terms of energy is a remarkable thing. I don't think most doctors think about that enough. They accomplish that, but I don't think they think about it. They think about it mostly in terms of this was a case of so-and-so, we gave them the right medicine or did the right operation, the patient got well, and that's fine. Better to be healthy than to be sick. But it's much better to be healthy than to be sick because of what you can do. We, as physicians, too often think that we're eradicating a negative. I think of it more as adding a positive to the life by getting rid of whatever's dysfunctional. So there were sessions in which a spectacular number of things were accomplished. We were both the patient and I were on a hot roll, you might say. All sessions clearly didn't go that way, and that's what's frustrating about a specialty like psychiatry. But it's the same thing for an internist who may spend 70 or 80% of any day dealing with psychosomatic complaints that he can't deal with effectively because he hasn't the experience, or dealing with a whole series of upper respiratory infections, one of which looks exactly like its clone, you know? In psychiatry, at least the way I felt my practice went, every day was an excitement. That didn't mean I didn't tire of it after 30 years, and didn't mean that I wasn't ready for something else. But I would not have chosen any other. There's the lady.
Hello.
You're home. You're home, Mama.
Hi.
Meet Marcy Schwartz.
Hi, Mom. It would have been nice to pick that little conversation up.
I wouldn't have made it.
Dr. Schwartz, what then led you, you were getting tired, what made you decide to retire when you did? You really
well, the retirement, see, I did both at the same time for a while, and they were wonderful years. I try to keep my practice going and do the what I was obligated to do vis-a-vis this project, which meant travel. And so we spent lots of time in Europe and around the country here while I was still in practice. And my patients all understood it. Many of them were ready to do without my presence on a weekly basis anyhow. And but after a while, when I started to think more in terms of new projects connected with this, it became clear that I was going to have to make a decision. And the decision was to go toward physiology, because I'd always wanted to be there in a sense anyhow, and now I had the chance to do it. And I was getting close to the twilight of my own career anyhow. I don't know that I would have been one of these guys who works on as a psychiatrist of 75 or 80 years old. I wouldn't fashion myself as a good ancient psychiatrist. So what I wanted to do is hasten to write a few books. And I'd been doing that in my time off. I'd come home from seeing 10 patients and start writing. In those days, I didn't even use a word processor, so I was writing by hand, and Millie was typing the stuff by typewriter. Now I live in an electronic medium where I can knock out a book sometimes in a week. I've knocked out a whole small book in a week, because I write up to, 6,000-7,000 words a day.
You initially said that, had you thought in terms of writing earlier, that may have been the way you went. How did you fall into writing? I mean, you developed heavy hands, but that's different than writing it.
Yeah.
So how did that develop?
Well, I was always a good English student in school. And I always got A's in my essays, and my teacher, professors at Pitt, were complimentary about my natural, so to speak, writing skill. It was something I never studied. I never took a course in creative writing, for example. And I always believed, as a matter of fact, probably a rationalization, that you write the way you should. Everybody can't write like Bill Buckley, I would hope. Anyhow. So when I got into these new ideas in the area of physiology, it was the most natural thing in the world for me to lean back on whatever writing I had been good at, in quotes, over my lifetime. So it was a natural coupling, I think. And then, for example, when I had the first book edited and published by Little Brown, I learned quite a bit from my editor. So that, the third book that I published, I had no editor. I felt able to edit my work myself. There were some chapters in the first book that they left untouched, as a matter of fact. So writing teaches writing. You have to write. Bernard Shaw said that you have to write in order to write. And he wrote 6 or 7, he didn't call them pages, somethings every day of his life, just to keep the craft going. So I would like to be a better writer. The problem with that is as you age, the business of acquiring more and more language skills becomes difficult, because the cerebral processes are slowing down. I'm trying to hasten up what is naturally moving at a more like a snail's pace. But nonetheless, I use dictionaries and thesauruses of all sorts in my computer to offset whatever losses, cerebral losses, I'm undergoing at this point in my life. I don't feel too much of that, but I know it's happening. It happens to all of us. The only difference between us is the rate at which it happened.
And that you know.
Mel, thanks. Just leave it there, buddy.
Okay.
Thanks very much.
Dr. Schwartz, are there any notable students that you have as a teacher that you'd like to comment on? Or
Tom Abel. Tom Abel, I think, is my most prized student in the area of physiology. Tom Abel, A-U-B-L-E. He was the one who did the hands-on research at the university all these years in physiologic stuff. Actually, the wonderful thing happened, the thing that's supposed to happen, happened there. I started out as his teacher, he ended up as mine. he became really a physiologist in the first class, pure sense of the word, because that was the program at the university. And I never was. I was an amateur to begin with. And though I still think in terms of maybe new ideas in the field of physiology in a different way than he does, he is the professional able to implement any idea I have in the sense of he can do statistics and do all that kind of analysis that I'm not good at. So it's a perfect kind of a team.
Where is he now, do you know?
Yes, he is now doing a fellowship at the university where he does research in emergency medicine.
At the University of
Pittsburgh? At the university, yeah. Somebody interviewed me this week for Pittsburgh Business Magazine. You know
it? Yes, I get it.
So you may see a little article about me, I don't but he wanted a couple of people to talk to, and I gave him Tom's name, and another name is a young man named John McCain. K-E-A-N. And John is the, I don't know if I mentioned him to you, he's the greatest weightlifter in the world, probably. He has been kind of a student over the phone. He's come here a few times, but essentially he has studied my techniques since their inception. And he owns more weightlifting records than any man alive.
And where is he?
He lives in Glassport, I believe, and he is a school teacher. And he's a very good writer. He writes on sports, he writes on fishing, but mostly he writes on weightlifting. It's quite interesting that his two sons, age 12 and 9, are the strongest kids their age in the world.
Is that right?
Yeah.
They've been recognized as?
Yes. Oh, they won huge trophies. John uses my techniques and actually goes out into the hinterlands and teaches my techniques to strength athletes. So it's really been fun to know him. And I don't know how much use I've been to him, but he's been a great deal of use to me. Super guy. Those are two students. My kids are all good exercisers. They don't do exactly what I'd want them to. They never do. But my grandson Jeremy is I've mentioned, I think, to you guys, is a perfect little athlete. And
Jeremy
David Bailey. He's the Bailey kid.
Jeremy.
Who has been called a Jubitarian.
Yes, sir. You said he was an excellent pitcher.
He's a league pitcher. In fact, yesterday I watched him all day, and we weren't supposed to do this, but we were down at CMU all by ourselves throwing a baseball around our young children.
Would you care to mention your other grandchildren's names and
sure.
ages?
Sure. Jeremy's 10. Ryan is 9. Laura is 8 and Michael is 7. You're what?
Just going back one more time to your professional life, you had mentioned the Jewish home.
Mm-hmm.
I was to remind you about the Jewish home. Could you tell us what there is to talk to us about?
Yeah, I started there about 12 years before my first book came out, so that would have been 1970. And I worked Friday afternoons as a consultant, as their psychiatric consultant.
Mm-hmm. In 1970?
Yeah, from 1970 to 1982. In 1982, we mutually decided that I was missing too many Fridays. My own practice I could miss, but the practice at the home was impossible because I would see 5-6 Alzheimer's patients every week, and they needed somebody there, and so that was the end of that. And it was not too after that, as I sort of tapered off from practice, and I began to see, first I closed my office, and I began to see patients here in this room, a small handful, who I thought it would have been kind of disastrous for me to stop suddenly. And in 6 or 8 months, I can't remember exactly, after I started that, I quit entirely.
Was there anything different about Jewish patients at the home than any others that you might remark, because perhaps they were Jewish?
I'm sure, I don't think I understand the question.
Was there any difference between the patients at the Jewish home and others?
Because they were Jewish, you mean?
Yeah, or for any reason.
Well, the cultural things obviously got into my conversations with the patients at the home, who were, in fact, all Jewish. I saw a few, because I gained some sort of a reputation as a quasi-expert in geropsychiatry. And so I began to see some Gentile and Jewish patients as outpatients in the office for some of those years. I can't say that from a psychiatrist's point of view I saw any evident difference, except the content of communication sometimes, you know, involved what went on the high holidays or what, whether they lit candles on Friday night.
You said that you developed quite a reputation.
I don't think I used the word quite. Some sort of a reputation. Quite a reputation would be gilding the lily a little bit.
This is the first that you've mentioned it, so could you tell us a little more about that?
Well, people are always looking for somebody to take care of old people. Okay. You know, any doctor who got involved in geriatrics soon could have a full schedule. I didn't want a full schedule in geriatrics. For a lot of reasons. Not that I was prejudiced against old people. Well, I was. I was probably prejudiced in a certain sense. I felt that some of the things I wanted to study, vis-a-vis the human soul, spirit, psyche, were better dealt with for people with the higher energy levels that you have in those who are younger. But today, over half the people in the country are over 40. And so geriatrics is really what every practitioner is going to be practicing, whether they like it or not.
Dr. Schwartz, could we just move on to perhaps your hobbies? And also, I'm supposed to drop the name Theodore Bacall.
Oh, yeah, Theodore Bacall, right. He was connected with one hobby, and that is playing the guitar. And singing a little bit. Many years ago, about the time his book came out on folk singing, which was a compilation of songs from maybe 50 different countries. So I got a chance to learn to sing a song in Russian and Serbian and Yiddish and Hebrew and many in French. Hungarian and Bolivian and God knows what. And that was just fun to do. My kids would join in and they became cosmopolites vis-a-vis folk singing. Hobbies. Athletics, of course, were always prominent in that.
Did you ever meet Bacall?
Never met. I bet you I bought Canada's books to give to people, including one that went to my psychoanalyst way back in 1961 or two. See, in a way, I wove projects into my practice that were like hobbies. My interest in, I've mentioned to you before, my interest in human vision became more than an academic, a clinical pursuit, it became a hobby. And to collect, as it were, information about facts that related personality with visual perception. So that's been those things. By the way, those hobbies and all the hobbies that I've ever had, I keep. I never give them up. I may drop them for time, only to come back to them. That happens with this too. When I go to Florida, I get furious about the guitar because suddenly a lot of time is freed up. You know, the computer has been a kind of a hobby for me, and I'm living in the Macintosh world, as they, some call it. Only when I was a kid did I ever collect things. I collected stamps for about a year, something like that. But I'm not. My Jeremy is a terrific collector, and I'm not. My wife and I, have collected some works of art. She being in the art gallery business, just painting.